Hey, welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kevan Davani. I'm really looking forward to my next special guest, Andy Edstrom, the author of Why Buy Bitcoin with the subtitle Investing Today in the Money of Tomorrow. It's a really excellent book. You should definitely read it. I love the style of writing. I love the research he did, his expertise, his background knowledge. So it's really worth reading. And, you know, in times of, infinite money printing, the viral meme that's been going around, and FDIC, you know, is this weird institution that allegedly, you know, secures or guarantees, assures, you know, your deposit, in at least in the United States, I know, has been coming out and saying, you shouldn't put your money under the mattress, so it's really secure. Since 1933 and blah, blah. So this is the sign that you should, think about as soon as possible, withdraw your money, put it into hardest money, such as Bitcoin, or even if you want, gold or whatever. It's not financial advice, but I'm just saying, do your own research first, educate yourself, but, you need to take human action, as the Austrian economists say. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to talking to Andy Edstrom, the author of Why Buy Bitcoin. And if you have any questions afterwards, let me know. If you and any other comments, questions, topics you want me to discuss with other authors or Bitcoiners, experts, let me know. So thank you so much for listening. And without further ado, this is my interview with Andy Edstrom. Thank you so much for your listening and for your support. Bye.
All right. Andy Edstrom, author of the book, of this really amazing book. Andy, welcome to the show, first of all. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevan. It's great to be on with you.
So listen, I ordered your book, but then, it didn't arrive. I was at my girlfriend's house, so I downloaded it on her Kindle, because I usually don't read Kindle. I like, physical books. So anyways, I read it, and some of the chapters I even read twice. And I was really blown away. It's not only your style of writing is really blew me off, because, usually I have sometimes I need some time to dig into the style of writing, but now to the content, I was really surprised, because you go into depth when it comes, what interests of me, is like the structural problems we have, the cause, not the symptoms. And you elaborate, you go really into the rabbit hole of the criminal, how else do we want to, not only unethical, but criminal procedures, processes, workings, background of this, financial banking, monetary, central banking structure, in collusion, of course, with the governmental positions that these people also fill in. So let me, if you like to, can we talk first about, what's your approach to this whole narrative and to this whole, to these factual backgrounds? How did you get into this research, first of all?
Yeah, okay. So first I'll do the usual disclaimer, which is none of this is investment advice, and these are opinions. These opinions are my own and not those of my employer, WestCap Group. So we got that out of the way. Yeah, regarding the system and the problem of, let's say, regulatory capture, as well as, criminality. And you could separate those two, I guess, or you could argue that they're related. I would probably say that they're related. But how did I get into the research? So the first part was the easy part, which is I used to work in that. I used to work for him, right? I used to work for Goldman Sachs before the financial crisis, when a lot of the shenanigans was going on. I was just a young analyst, so I didn't have great grasp of what was going on at the time. There were inklings of it. There were hints here and there, and I wrote about some of them in the book. And then, of course, the global financial crisis happened, and a lot of this stuff came to light. And so that, I guess, prompted my my research of it. I had begun reading about it after I had left the bank, and when I was working at a distressed investment fund called Tenenbaum Capital. And so part of that was just, you know, attempt to understand, you know, what the heck was going on. Literally as the financial crisis was playing out, you know, when Lehman filed, well, first you had the Bear Stearns, you know, funds blow up, and then you had Lehman file for bankruptcy, and then you had all these rushed acquisitions among all the banks. And so I was left scratching my head. And so I definitely spent some time reading and researching at that time. And then as time passed, I just, you know, as a professional investor, paid attention to what was going on in the industry. And I noticed that a lot of the problems, you know, weren't solved. They didn't go away. Government probably had the opportunity to solve more of the problems that were in existence in the financial system, whether it relates to, you know, people being in and out of the private sector and government and helping out their friends and cronies, and making sure that, you know, making sure that people high in government, regulators in particular, had nice cushy jobs to go to after they left government and could make their large payouts, right? Get paid, because government doesn't pay nearly as well. Whether it was the leverage embedded in the system, that's sort of the one area that I can say, okay, there was some progress with respect to, you know, the banks used to be 30 to 40 times levered and now they're only 10 times levered. Now, a footnote to that is based on, you know, valuations, you know, what's fair valuation of these assets. Well, we're finding out right now, specifically in the debt markets, literally as we speak over the last week, we're figuring out that quote unquote safe, you know, safe paper, right? Safe fixed income investments, whether those be government bonds, whether those be real estate, especially, right, the mortgage-backed securities market has totally blown out. So the market is struggling right now to find what is fair value for these things. And so we've got this confluence of a liquidity problem and too much leverage and deleveraging, right? So that's going on. It seems that some of the very large hedge funds, especially the risk parity funds that use leverage on fixed income assets, are having to unwind these things. So you're getting forced selling, and that's a quote liquidity problem. However, what we're going to find out in the coming months is how much of it was truly just a liquidity problem and how much of it was a solvency or valuation problem, right? Are houses in the US, you know, are houses in my neighborhood, you know, really worth 10 times the annual income? That's where they've been selling for the last, you know, few years, but we could see a repricing in those kinds of assets, just like we already have in the stock market and other risk assets. So I digress from your original question. But yeah, I've lived and observed the problems with the existing banking system and financial system, you know, my whole career. And over time, it's just kind of become more and more apparent that we have those problems. Now, as to the specific, you know, criminality of the banks, that was a couple things. One was, if you read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times on a regular basis, like, how can it not just hit you over the head, right? I mean, it's just scandal after scandal and problem after problem. And it's, you know, whether it's literally the HSBC working with the Mexican cartels and specifically designing, systems in their banks that will fit the right size briefcase full of cash to launder money, or it's the, you know, fixing of LIBOR, which is probably the most important interest rate in the world, you know, other than the 10-year treasury rate. And, you know, there's literally tens of trillions, if not hundreds of trillions of dollars of notional assets that are tied to that thing. That was, you know, rigged and manipulated. The metals market was manipulated. You've had obviously the Wells Fargo, you know, situation where they basically committed fraud and illegally opened millions of customer accounts without the consent of the account holders. And it's just all this stuff. I mean, you can't you can't have been reading the news for the last few years and not have noticed the criminality that's going on in the banking system. And so then when it came to writing the book, it was really just a question of, okay, what are these scandals that I literally remember off the top of my head? Quick Google search, you know, find the Wall Street Journal article or the New York Times article or the, you know, Economist article that, you know, that reported on it, you know, do the citation. And so that's where the internet's an amazing thing, right? If you have a few ideas in your mind and you remember these things, and you might not remember all the details, you might not remember exactly when they happened. And of course, the most egregious example being probably the most recent, which was this Danske Bank case, where literally over 200 billion euros, which is equivalent to more than $200 billion, was laundered through a single branch in Estonia, I think it was, right? Over a period of years. And so that's the one that's sort of most recent and most egregious. And that was, you know, that was like a year ago. So that's the long and winding answer to, I think, your question about, you know, yeah, how I got into the research on this stuff. It wasn't, really, unfortunately, it wasn't that difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. You see, the thing is, I mean, I really, because I really went into, you know, deep into the rabbit hole of the Bank for International Settlements. And I'm like, you know, as much as we want to understand and as much as we, you know, we are bombarded with all kinds of mainstream news and this and that story, but at the end of the day, it's like the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's like how deep, like these are like factual things that we can prove or have been, you know, in a court of law or something, or actually they haven't been, or they've just been fined. That's what they, you know, it's sort of a trade-off these institutions, these really huge institutions are doing. So, and it comes, you know, before I forget, your book title is Why Buy Bitcoin? Investing Today in the Money of Tomorrow. So I like your title because, you know, it goes to the core of this question, why buy Bitcoin? I mean, first we need to understand, you know, legacy, traditional monetary financial system before we go even into the, you know, into the alternatives or into the, potential solutions of what is Bitcoin, why Bitcoin. So do you want to like recapitulate what's been going on the last couple of days and weeks?
I'll try to keep it short. It's almost, you know, we could probably spend all afternoon talking about it. I'll cite a couple examples of, you know, what's happened as well as, you know, my thoughts, you know, today and earlier. So, you know, last Friday, I tweeted that within a week, you know, majority of U.S. cities would be under curfew. Okay, 6 minutes later, 6 minutes later, you can't make this stuff up. Oh, the city of Los Angeles announces a broad curfew, and that's where I live, by the way. I had no inside information on this.
Yeah, I guess it's much more stricter than over here in Austria because it's pretty relaxed over here in Vienna. You know, you don't get like, just asking. I mean, is it like super strict or how?
I mean, look, people are definitely, you know, walking by. They're taking walks. You know, they're getting exercise, which I think is good. I mean, I think they're mostly staying away from people. There's not much traffic on the roads. It's not totally deserted. There's definitely people driving around. You know, banks are open. So yeah, I mean, it's not, based on what I've read, it's not nearly as strict as, you know, China, or even potentially Italy right now. So yeah, it's not sort of Eastern country or Asian country level of lockdown by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, you've seen basically, states and, cities, you know, municipalities so far, you know, come out and do this. And by the way, it's been liberal, right? Democratic states and municipalities, right? It's New York, it's LA, state of California, you know, city and state of New York. I think more are going to fall into place. I was having actually this argument on sort of on email with a friend of mine, very good investor, you know, who I've known since college. And he takes the view that is in the US, you know, you can't basically impose lockdown. I still like my chances on my 1 week prediction that the majority of the US population will be under curfew. Because remember, it doesn't have to come from the president. It might come from the president, but it could come from, you know, states or cities. And frankly, you know, it's the liberal locations, right? It's the left-leaning, let's see, say more socialist or more communal areas where most of the people live. So anyway, we'll see how it plays out. So that's one thing that's, I think, surprising a lot of people. The second thing that I tweeted out on March 13th was, I was reading at the time about what a disaster this virus situation is and how the current administration, right, the Trump administration, totally blew it. And they did blow it, but guess what? So did everybody else. So people were talking about, you know, this is the, you know, this is the end of the Trump administration. And what I tweeted out on the 13th was the opposite, right? I personally put odds of Trump's reelection now at probably close to 75%, right? Mm. Which is really high for a presidential reelection. Why? Well, we're now on a war footing, right? And wartime leaders, for the most part, get reelected. I'm sure you've been looking at, you know, what's going on in France with Macron as a good example. Mm-hmm. And I wish that a single Western country had gotten this right. But I can't think of one, right? So like, yes, China did the lockdown, although they started late. Singapore, you know, seems to have done well. South Korea seems to have done well. Well, those are Asian Eastern countries. I mean, the relevance to our way of life over here is, it's just not that relevant. So when it come re-election time, when Western voters, American voters specifically, are looking around and saying, you know, did this guy blow it or not? It's going to be, I can't think of an example. You should interrupt me and tell me of a Western country basically that has handled this thing, you know, right. So he looks no worse basically than his peers. And moreover, you know, who is it that suffers the worst, let's say, from a highly contagious disease, you know, in an environment where you're potentially subject to lockdown? Well, it's the left-leaning, you know, Democratic voting states, right? If you're living in a rural area and you've already done your prepping, right? You've already stockpiled your goods and you've got the weapons to defend them. You're not as worried about this thing, and rightly so. Like, this is a disaster for people in New York City. It's not as much of a disaster, you know, for people in rural America, and rural America is where Trump's voter base is. And moreover, it's yet another, you know, nail in the coffin of globalization and, you know, this concept of the liberal elite, you know, the left-leaning liberal elite, and this notion that, you know, hey, everything open is the right thing, is the right thing to be. Surprise, surprise. Now we are, because we don't control our supply chains, you know, because we can't get masks and we can't get ventilators, you know, in time, potentially in time, we're going to find out.
Isn't that really strange, Andy? I mean, yeah. You know, we have so many resources, we have so many companies, we have you know, there's so much, you know, real resources. I mean, why can't there, you know, be a innovative approach to this, like, you know, getting out these test kits? What's happening here? I mean, it's really strange.
It is disappointing. I mean, definitely there's some government failure. I mean, specifically, as we know, the FDA was not helpful in this respect. So there's that, there's definitely that piece of it. And then part of it is the testing is one thing, you know, and then the having enough, you know, ICU beds and ventilators is another thing. There's little doubt that our system is not set up for, you know, peak demand, right? Or peak, we don't have the capacity for peak demand. And that is all related to the root of capitalism, or one of the roots of capitalism, or really specifically fiat, you know, money and debt money supported capitalism, whereby You keep just-in-time inventory. You squeeze down your working capital to the very minimal amount, which is good for, you know, reduces your total cost of capital. It's good for your share price. But if you have a problem, man, you know, it's centralization and living on the edge, and it's the opposite of robustness, where robustness is about decentralization, about not having too much concentration, about having, you know, a little less optimization so that when shit hits the fan, you've got a little bit of a cushion, a little bit of a buffer. But yeah, it's been somewhat surprising to see the, you know, the healthcare system's response to this. And this is another discussion I was having with my colleagues. You know, one of my colleagues took the view, hey, you know, this could be a real interesting opportunity to invest in healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. There could be a lot of investment in the space and growth in the space upcoming, as well as obviously demand for medical services. Mm-hmm. And I took the opposite view. I said, you know, if the US already spends double as a percentage of GDP on healthcare compared to Europe, as you know, right? I'm generalizing, it's different in each country. But on average, you know, if we spend whatever, 17 or 18% of GDP on healthcare, and, you know, I don't know what Austria spends, maybe 10 probably would be my guess. And we're getting no better outcomes. You know, this could be the straw that breaks the camel's back on nationalizing healthcare. We'll see. It might not, and it might not soon, right? I mean, if Trump gets reelected, it probably won't happen. But if and when we get a, you know, democratic sweep of government, you know, people could look at this situation and say, you know, this really expensive healthcare system that we've had in place for so long that already wasn't really getting us better outcomes, you know, except for extreme cases. Well, now it failed us utterly. You know, what are we doing here?
Right. So the yeah. So this SARS corona, whatever, COVID-19 virus is one way or another, it's a convenient you know, event and excuse for all the governments to you know, to disguise, or to try at least, you know, attempt to disguise the real causes of you know, of all these of the mess we've been in, you know, with now they're, you know, starting with the brrr, this meme that's been going around. So where do you see this going? I mean, are we going to get out of this, or are we going to go, you know, into a totally, you know, different extreme?
So I have a few thoughts on this. One is one of the things I wrote about in the book, right? I dedicated a couple pages in the book specifically to the upcoming intergenerational struggle, okay? And this was at some risk to myself, because the majority of my clients are much older than me. Okay. They're baby boomers. Some of them are older, and they don't understand how much they've sucked out of the financial system already, not only by virtue of the fact of the, you know, outright entitlements, right? That's Medicare and Social Security, but also by virtue of the fact that they've, you know, they had careers and they accumulated wealth in a period when, as a society, we were living beyond our means, right? And that basically accrued to their investments and their savings over time. So what's happening right now is very interesting, because we're faced with actual financial calculations and numbers. So, and I'll tell you how I'm thinking about that. So first of all, we don't know, you know, what the death rate will be from this thing. That's number one. But it could be substantial, okay? And, you know, estimates are that it could be, let's say in the US, we got 350 million people. You know, we could have a couple million people die of this thing. It could be worse, or it could be better than that. And it obviously depends on what policies are enacted, right? Whether you're in favor of the lockdowns and the social distancing or not, you know, it seems to at least flatten the curve. Okay. So now we get into questions of, well, who's going to be hurt by the situation, right? And what is the magnitude? So who's dying, right? Now, look, I'll tell you my personal view. I've been personally in lockdown. I haven't left my house in 9 days. Okay. I do that for a few reasons. One, I have a couple of kids, one of whom, you know, doesn't have great health and I don't want to expose them. Two is, even though I might not die this thing, like, I don't really want to get a bad flu, you know, for a week with a risk of, you know, having to go to the hospital. And, you know, I need to be in shape basically to continue to do my job and serve my clients and that stuff. Now, look, I'm lucky. I can do this, right? There are plenty of people, I can work remotely. I've been set up to work remotely for years now already. And so it's not it. And I have, you know, like a decent house, you know, I have enough space. Like being locked down and holed up at home is not such a sacrifice for me. It's a little bit of a sacrifice, but compared to, you know, the average American or the average person around the world, it's not that great a sacrifice, honestly. So it's kind of, it's easy. It's relatively easier for me to do. Now, so then the question is, okay, who's at risk? Well, on average, obviously, it's mostly older people, right? They're the ones who are much more likely to die so far based on the statistics we've seen. So, and then we got what's Congress doing right now? We're talking about a $2 trillion stimulus package, okay? And that's literally just, it's $2 trillion of deficit spending, right? It's $2 trillion at least of debt that the U.S. government will incur, you know, to quote unquote help people out. Well, who's going to benefit and who's going to lose from this whole, you know, lockdown situation? Well, obviously, it's the old people that are going to benefit disproportionately. Why? They're the ones at risk, right? They're the ones who are much more likely to literally die of, you know, this thing. Whereas the young people, you know, who don't have accumulated assets and also aren't, you know, are much less likely to get very sick or risk their lives, you know, they're getting laid off, you know, literally by the millions. Because they're the ones working the service jobs, you know, that are basically getting gutted. So they don't have nearly as much to lose with respect to health, but they have a lot to lose with respect to, you know, earnings and well-being. And then the opposite is true for older the older generation. So then you get into the question of like, well, is it worth it overall? Well, let's say that 2 million Americans might die. And let's say that's going to cost us $2 trillion, okay, because that's the number that's being, you know, kicked around right now. I mean, we'll see what Congress announces. Okay, is it worth spending $2 trillion to save 2 million lives? I think it depends on whose life it is, right? That's $1 million per life. Now, back in my Keynesian economics days, right, studying economics at university, they told us at that time that, you know, when the economists try to value a human life, you know, the economic value, they come up with pretty big numbers, you know, on the order of 10 million. But remember, that's based on expected life productivity, right? So then you have to say, well, what's the expected lifetime productivity of a 70-year-old? Well, actually, it may be zero or near zero because they're already retired. So you're going to saddle a young, you know, the younger generation with a bunch more debt, you know, to protect the lives of the older generation, you know, at the cost of, you know, $1 million a life. I don't know. We're going to find out. But I can tell you that the burden of this whole situation, the financial burden, is not going to fall evenly on the population. And then there's a further issue, which is, so far, when you talk about, you know, wealth loss, let's say, you talk about, you know, stock market loss, you know, who's lost money? Well, obviously, wealthier people have lost more money in the stock market than people with less wealth. That's actually, you know, running counter to the narrative of, you know, extreme and widening wealth inequality, at least in the short term. But when you think about portfolio construction, because that's what I do for a living, the older you are, actually, in a lot of cases, the more bonds you own or the more low-risk investments you own, and therefore sort of the more insulated you are against loss. Now, that's a generalization. I mean, plenty of older people own lots of equities, right? They own lots of stocks. So their portfolios have gotten whacked to some degree. But it's actually the younger risk to, you know, younger generations who are taking more risk with their investment portfolio and or the sort of middle-aged people in their peak earning years who've already accumulated some assets but still have, you know, a strong skew toward riskier assets. They're the ones who are suffering most, at least as a percentage, with the market losses in recent days. So anyway, all of this is going to lay bare to a greater degree the sort of skews and inequities between the generations. And yeah, it's going to be it's going to feed into politics. It's going to be problematic. You know, I've tried to warn my clients that this conflict is coming. Some of them, you know it. Some of them have realized it more recently. Some will still be surprised. It's going to be a reckoning. I don't know if that answered your question. I mean, I have a lot of other thoughts about what else is going on in financial markets, which I'm happy to talk about. But
all right. So those 2 trillion that you're talking about, this is just a minimum, right? I mean, we're talking about like, if this process goes on, wouldn't that be like compounded probably to 5 to 10 trillion? I mean, it's being injected now into the, you know, artificially into the market. It's like really with the physical money printing or digital, money printing or credit expansion by order of magnitude. So where is this money going? What kind of effect does this have, you know, on also, you know, since it's about Bitcoin, what effect is going to have on Bitcoin and gold and what is happening, you know, right now in the situation?
So a few things there. The short answer is we don't know. We just don't know how much money's going to get printed. I mean, the Fed literally announced, you know, they had the whatever it takes moment, right? You know, Mario Draghi did that in 2011 in Europe. And now we've done it here. So it's a blank check. It's literally, as you say, money printer go brr. It's there's money getting printed as we speak. You know, assets are going to be bought directly, you know, assets that hadn't been bought before. You know, before it was only basically government debt, that's treasuries, and mortgage debt, you know, in previous rounds of QE.
And now they're going to buy also corporate bonds, right? I mean,
exactly. That's the next. It's everything but stocks so far. Everything but stocks and Bitcoin, as far as we know. Who knows? Maybe that'll happen before too long. So potentially unlimited money printing. Now, you know, those of us in this space, probably, you know, you, most of your listeners, me, like we've known this has been coming. I mean, I dedicated, you know, a couple chapters in my book specifically to the debt problem, right? And the fact that printing money is probably the only way out. So there's that situation. With respect to gold, I'm really happy, you know, that my clients own gold. We put that in the portfolio for the first time, I think in 2016, and we've been increasing it, you know, basically since then. And gold is like the obvious short-term beneficiary for all this, because gold is the historical hard money, right? Now, Bitcoin, I believe, has a very good chance of becoming, you know, the future hard money. And so it should be very good for Bitcoin. I can sort of imagine scenarios for why, you know, a truly deep depression and really off the rails government policy could be bad for Bitcoin in the short term. But if we don't get a Great Depression, it seems that this is just more evidence that owning hard money, hard to produce money, inflation resistant money, you know, is going to be a good idea. So I am very bullish on gold. I am very bullish on Bitcoin. And these two assets actually may be the assets to own in this decade. And, you know, we can debate, okay, you know, will Bitcoin take share from gold? Yes. I think Bitcoin will take share from gold. Okay. Nevertheless, I think the total aggregate demand for hard money will be so large and will increase by so much that both of these assets are likely to perform well. And for a broadly diversified portfolio, you know, you ought to own both of them.
Right. Yeah. What about, I don't know who that was that Pelosi or whatever, let's just call it the Trump administration, they proposed digital, fiat dollar wallet. It's would be sort of connected to a Federal Reserve account or some kind of member bank, credit union, like any affiliate bank. So it would be like purely digital then, centralized, of course, so it's fiat money. So do you think that would facilitate and accelerate the transition to critical mass adoption, a critical adoption rate of Bitcoin?
Yeah,
Because of
the
the
short
pending,
answer.
because of the danger of
Yeah,
hyperinflations, you know?
yeah,
So.
yeah. The short answer is I think that, well, the short answer is I don't know and we don't know. And I did write some about this in the book. It depends greatly on the form it takes, right? So if it's literally, private key based and it's direct access to this ledger and it's sort of, independent of the banking system, it's effectively that the citizen has an account with the Federal Reserve. That would be a pretty interesting development. However, I think it's highly unlikely that it happens. Why? Because circumventing the banking system will, potentially severely reduce the depository base of the banks, and that would be hugely disruptive to their business. And it seems that the government wants to keep the banking system, functional and solvent. Whether because that's a good idea in general to keep the payment system running, which is actually true, or it's because the banks have captured government, which is also true. So for whether for good reasons or bad reasons, that seems to be the case. So I have to confess, I haven't dug into the details of, preliminary systems that have been proposed lately. Because these are, I don't think I've seen anything that's sort of risen to the level of, oh, this is likely to get implemented. I mean, you've seen some ideas come from, individual Congress people, and you've seen sort of white papers, published by the Fed and others. So we'll see what happens. I really kind of doubt that it's going to be a true, I doubt that we're going to see a system like I described soon, just because it would be so potentially disruptive to the banking system. And it's really hard for me to see that government is going to be, willing to do that anytime soon.
What about the universal basic income? Do you think it's, I mean, do you have any choice? I mean, because if the shit hits the fan, I mean, wouldn't they like, isn't that like the most rational, alternative or choice to, to execute because of the danger of, a civil war? I mean, I if this thing goes on, I see, real huge disruption and millions or, hundreds of millions of people on the streets. Don't you see like the danger of really impoverished society?
Big time. If when you get mass unemployment, which is what we face if there is, a long-term, curfew and quarantine, right? And obviously, unemployment claims are already skyrocketing. So we're already starting to see it. Yeah, if people don't have income, and as we know, by the way, most Americans, and frankly, most people in the world don't have any significant savings, right? They don't have enough money to pay the rent and buy groceries, for more than a month. And there's a lot of Americans, as we know, that can't. They don't basically have $400 in their checking account. So yeah, you got to keep these people. You got to make sure these people can literally live their lives, and that's why they're talking about literally, mailing checks, or as you suggest, having some digital distribution system for getting cash to people. The problem, and maybe this gets to your earlier question, with that, with the implementation. I mean, there's a lot of problems with the implementation. It's hard to implement. It's hard to get, although checks in the mail and, the system, the mail system are slow, at least they're already in place. Rolling out and implementing a mass digital based, UBI system. This is where people are talking about, well, is the US government going to roll out a new crypto dollar system, specifically because we need payment of UBI to people right now?
Which
It
would be
seems
so
unlikely.
difficult to implement, I think. It's just a centralized, data ledger. The more centralized, the easier it is, right, to roll it out.
Yeah, in theory. In theory, that's true. Remember, governments aren't very good at turning on a dime. They're actually pretty good, you know, at taking a year or two, you know, to get on a war footing and mobilize the machine, but they're not that good at doing something, you know, in the span of weeks or a couple months. So I agree with you in premise, but as a practical matter, I just see the execution risk of that as being rather high. And just sort of, it adds complexity to what's already a potentially dire problem where, yeah, I don't think you use that opportunity immediately to roll out, you know, a digital payment system. Now, is it an opportunity to start earnestly working on it, you know, and then rolling it out some period of months from now? Maybe, but then, you know, you still, I don't know, you still face the problem of, you know, what have you really implemented? It just doesn't look, it's not going to, I don't think it's going to look very much like Bitcoin, you know, or a, you know, distributed ledger crypto asset. It's possible, but it seems quite unlikely. Okay.
All right. Well, if it's, you know, because I was listening to this interview with Anthony Pampoliano, Pomp, and Preston Pish, and I mean, I'm just paraphrasing it, but you can listen to it yourself. But I said, you know, I would agree even with Preston Pish that that this digital wallet, whatever form this UBI would be, you know, transferred to the people in need, don't you think it would be like a trigger for people like waking up and understanding for the first time, you know, what kind of value, purchasing power has this money and Bitcoin, you know, like, and then eventually they would be sort of, you know, get into a situation because of the circumstances, the conditions to educate themselves, like, oh, wow, you know, like now I can even, you know, put part of that money into Bitcoin and eventually, you know, reach that critical adoption rate.
Yeah. Look, I haven't listened to that interview. I mean, I intend to. You know, I love press and stuff. And I think that I can definitely hear the argument that if it's a new digital based system that causes people to have to do something different than they used to, and it's based on the internet, then sure, that can certainly help break the mold of the existing systems that have been in place, you know, for so long. So yeah, I'll buy that argument. I think that it should help to open people's minds to, oh, you know, maybe there's some other alternate system other than the systems I've been using for years and years and years that could work. And if the system, you know, if there is something else that works, then why not this other thing that works? You know, why not this Bitcoin thing? So yeah, I mean, it seems like a potential positive. I'm not going to hang my hat on like, this is going to be the catalyst. If the question is like, what's going to be the catalyst for, you know, for Bitcoin. And by the way, I do think this whole situation has accelerated the timeline, you know, for Bitcoin for sure. I do think it means that we're that much closer to much more accrued debt. The most likely resolution of which is inflation. And so we're much closer to, yeah, we're much closer to that inflationary environment of, you know, 5% to 8%, you know, consumer price inflation, CPI, or however you measure it, than we were recently. And in the short term, it's really hard to say. Like, it could be deflationary. We could have a deflationary demand shock, right? Because nobody's buying anything except the bare essentials. And so that will last for some period of months, and then it'll pass. And then we're in the situation of, I guess we're where we were before, but now there's even more debt and even more government spending. And it's hard to see how that's not ultimately inflationary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the global implications? I mean, do you see like, you know, when you zoom out, like, you know, we've got insolvency with German banks over here in Europe, in the European Union.
Yeah.
Do you see like,
So the short answer is, we just don't know. We do know that there's a lot of debt in the system, and we know that there's a lot more debt than there was in history, and that is a destabilizing factor. So we know that. I do think that, you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, Trump and re-election. I do think that this whole situation, you know, plays perfectly into the nationalist, jingoistic, you know, hostile foreign policy footing that we were sort of already on, right? Like, the virus came out of China. It was another attack, you know, on us. And it's just, a, you know, the latest example of how stupid it was to reroute our supply chains, you know, through China. Because now we really need to manufacture this essential stuff and we can't do it. And so that is bad for geopolitics. I mean, that is just a world in which hostilities are not, they're not reduced from what they already were before. And already, you know, we were basically back in, we were in a Cold War with China. I'm saying we as an American. So that's, you know, that's clearly a major, the major environment. Now, with respect to your question about, you know, what's going to happen to the banking system, I'm actually less worried about the banking system now than I was in the global financial crisis. You know, I'm more worried about people's savings and pensions. You know, and obviously I'm concerned for, you know, my clients that have, you know, significant equity exposure. And so those things are concerning for me. And then obviously I'm worried about the shadow banking system. So if the US banking system was much better capitalized this time around than it was, mm-hmm. you know, 11 years ago or 12 right. years ago, that's good. But yeah, the, you know, the systems, the lending institutions and the levered vehicles, you know, hedge funds or otherwise, are the area that I'm more concerned about. And for sure that'll have knock-on effects to, you know, the rest of the banking system. So yeah, I mean, overall, sure, I'm worried about the financial system. I mean, I wrote about it, you know, I spent two or three chapters of my book writing about those problems. So if I was worried then then yes, I'm still worried now.
Yeah. What about the pension funds, Andy? Do you think, I mean, aren't they really broke? I mean, this is what I'm really worried for a lot of people. What about the pension funds? Unfunded yeah. liabilities, all these, you know, when you aggregate them together with all the global debt, which yeah. is a bubble. Yeah,
it's a huge concern. I mean, pensions in the US, I can speak more for, you know, US pensions because yeah. I'm more familiar with those, you know, at the state level in particular, as well as corporate pensions. They've been assuming, you know, 7-8% annualized rates of return in perpetuity, more or less. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, that was a joke. That was already a joke before this recent crisis. And now it's clearly laid bare. There is, I don't actually know the aggregate number, but it must be in, you know, the trillions in yeah. terms of actual, let's say, underfunded liability. You won't find it on any of their balance sheets, right? Because they've got these ridiculous assumptions. Yeah. But yes, the reality of it is hugely underfunded.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely worry about, you know, it's interesting. I'll give you specific sort of, a specific example, like what I, you know, do for my business. One of the things I do for my clients is I do long-term financial projections. And one of the major areas of that, or one of the major factors is like, you know, how much Social Security am I going to get, right? And we have always, I shouldn't say always, at least since 2016, but I think earlier than that, you know, basically had the assumption that your Social Security benefit is going to be in purchasing power terms, in real terms, is going to be substantially lower than, you know, the stated nominal rate, including the fact that even though it's stated that today it's protected against inflation, right? They have escalators for consumer price inflation. We have for years been using the assumption that, you know, those escalators are not going to fully protect you. And yeah, I have to say, if anything, you know, my view is probably even more bearish on that than it was before. And I'm sure the things that are coming to light now and the world we're living in now is unfortunately going to surprise some people.
Yeah. But it's good. I mean, people are waking up, as if you might have, heard or read on Twitter, and more people are asking questions about Bitcoin. So people are waking up. That's the good thing. What I'm really intrigued is that not, let's say the average middle class, not lower class, but middle class, upper middle class, hasn't really grasped the fundamental power of Bitcoin, the value proposition of Bitcoin. But I think it's going to happen soon. I feel it. It's coming. Where do you see this on? Where do you see on the horizon? This
Yeah.
critical
Where's the
adoption.
where's
Yeah.
where's the psyche, where's the you know the public psyche gonna go? When do we get that mass adoption, inflection point?
Of
Kayvon, I
course, it's
wish
the
I knew.
pain. Of course, it's the pain. The
Yeah.
suffering, the need, the necessity. I understand that, but. People, I mean, are not that stupid, I think. They look around, they see everything, they see what the Federal Reserve or all the central banks are doing. So it's not that they're, people are not stupid, but what does it take to, open up and really go into the rabbit hole?
Yeah. What does it take to get, what does it take to get 30% of the population invested in Bitcoin, right? Or more. Yeah, I mean the catalysts that have been in my mind and continue to be in my mind are one is price. So there is the psychological element of once we break through the all-time high, right? Once we blow through 19 or 20K again, then it will trigger people's memory. 'Cause that is one of the things about this thing, at least in my experience, right? I think I mentioned earlier that the first time, or this is before we started recording, was it the first time I read about Bitcoin? I was actually in or near Vienna. I was on a trip, right? This is 2013. I read an article about it and I totally ignored it. And then I had a second exposure a few years later, and it wasn't until the third exposure, right, that it started to sink in. There's no question in my mind that there are, millions of folks in America, and I'm sure in countries in Europe and all over the world. When they start reading the headlines of, oh, it's reached a new all-time high and it's still not dead. And I remember reading articles about this thing, back in 2017. So that'll be a major catalyst. Also just actual inflation, I think popping up to more interesting levels will be a catalyst. And that's gonna happen. I mean, it was already gonna happen. I wrote in the book that the Fed actually issued a written statement, which they basically doubled down on, but this was May of 2019, where they talk about the inflation target being symmetric, right? What does that mean? It means that if our target is 2%, and according to our numbers, we've been undershooting the target for years, well, then it'd be okay to overshoot it for years. Well, they're going to get their wish. I mean, they already were, but now they've, now it's clear. Now they've opened up the spigots and said, we're going to print as much as it takes. So once people start to see, I think, a significant increase in inflation, and a significant loss to their savings, that's going to grab their attention. I don't know when that, I don't know when that happens in the short to medium term because we just don't know what this whole virus situation is going to look
Right,
like. In the
but it could
short term, it's
happen,
deflationary.
right? It could happen real fast, right? I mean,
Yeah, it could happen real fast. I mean, we could be out of this thing and having taken on a bunch more government debt and having printed a bunch of money, 6 months from now,
right.
and inflation starts to spike and people start saying, oh my God, it's happening. It's 2020. That is entirely possible, along at the same time that we got the halving, right? And the supply cut, it is very possible that we could see a massive spike, this year, or it could take longer. You're not going to pin me down. You're not going to pin me down on
No, no, no. I don't want that. No,
the
no. No, I just wanted to know, what do you see on the horizon, and how do you see this, unfolding? So, yeah, Andy, I don't want to take too much time. I would love to continue this maybe in a panel discussion with other Bitcoiners, in the, near future. Where can people find you? Do you want to share your
Yeah,
info?
cool. No, it's been fun talking to you, Kayvon. Obviously the book is called Why Buy Bitcoin: Investing Today in the Money of Tomorrow, and it's on Amazon. You can follow me on Twitter. It's Edstrom Andrew at G or it's Edstrom Andrew is the handle. My firm is called WestCap Group, and And yeah, those are the, oh, and I have a personal website, you know, andyedstrom.com. And I do have a list of all my, you know, podcast appearances. I've done, I think, about 7 of them.
Okay.
And I will certainly add this one to that list. So, it's been a pleasure. It's wild times. I feel like we barely scratched the surface on some of the stuff that's going on. But yeah, suffice to say, there's a lot of Bitcoiners out there, I'm sure, in your audience who are saying, it's happening. Like, it's happening now. And I hope they're right. I kind of think, at minimum, I think that the timeline has been significantly accelerated from where it was before.
Right. Andy, stay healthy. Take good care, and hope, you know, to stay in touch with me. All right. For the
future. Yeah, we'll do, Kayvon. Have a good one.
Bye bye. All right. What you think about this really interesting conversation with Andy Edstrom, the author of this amazing book, Why Buy Bitcoin? With the subtitle, Investing Today in the Money of Tomorrow. And should definitely check it out. It's really, really well written, really well researched. Can only recommend it. If you loved it as much as I did, please give it a like. Love it, share it, retweet it, follow me. Also follow Andy Edstrom on Twitter, and would also, you know, appreciate a positive review on any podcast platform. If you are, you know, ethical Bitcoin sponsor, get in touch with me. My email address is hello@thetotalconnector.com. And I would really thank you so much for listening and for your support. To all my listeners, my followers, my subscribers, subscribe please. And hope we can, yeah, continue these conversations in the very near future. And thank you so much again. Bye.